Welcome to the BIOS podcast by Ilix Ventures. BIOS is a community of early stage healthcare and life sciences founders and investors. BIOS curates content, hosts events, crafts resources, and creates a community to facilitate collaboration. BIOS unites like-minded members of the startup universe and is anchored by Ilix Ventures, a San Francisco-based venture fund that invests in early stage healthcare and life sciences companies. To learn more about us, visit bios.community or ilix.vc.
Hello and welcome to BIOS Podcast. Today, we're absolutely thrilled to welcome
Daryl Irvin,
serial entrepreneur, professor at MIT, HHMI investigator, and the associate director of the Koch Institute for Integrative Cancer Research, the show. Daryl, thank you once again for joining us, and a huge congratulations for just this Monday being inducted into the National Academy of Medicine.
Thanks so much, Chris. Great to be here.
To help host this episode, I'm joined by my special guest, Jake Beecraft, CEO and co-founder of Strand Therapeutics. Jake, can you give a very quick introduction on yourself and Strand? Maybe mention how you got to know Daryl.
I met Daryl quickly after coming to MIT and joining Ron Weiss's lab over 10 years ago now, Daryl. Daryl and Ron had started working on some very exciting work in programmable messenger RNA, genetic circuits, and the application of it in vaccines and ideally beyond. And we got to work together on a DARPA project, the same DARPA project that was backing Moderna in the early days. And then that work went on to form the basis of research that became the company Strand Therapeutics, which is a company I've been the co-founder and CEO of for the past 5 years, which Daryl is also a co-founder of along with me and on our SAB, where we built next generation messenger RNA therapeutics for immuno-oncology and ideally also beyond.
Thank you, Jake. Daryl, anything you want to add to Jake's recollection? Any fun or interesting anecdotes about his time at MIT?
can't believe it's been 10 years, but yeah. I was just thinking, you know, with the Nobel Prize going to Katie Carrico, I can remember in the early days of our RNA work in Ron's lab that Desuku and Jake, who are the co-leads at Strand, would be writing to Katie when she had moved to BioNTech, and she was very helpful in our early going. So,
yeah, Desuku hosted her for a seminar at MIT. And then Desuku and I went to BioNTech with Katty and Uger to talk about our programmable messenger RNA work to BioNTech and Tron, which was the research institute. So incredible to see her win the Nobel Prize last week.
Yeah, it's well deserved.
Just a fun anecdote from the early days when Jake and I first got to know each other.
Yeah.
No, it's always exciting when things come full circle. And Daryl, let's kick things off and focus a little bit more about you now. Can you rewind the clock and maybe share a little bit more about your background and just a quick career overview with us in the audience?
Yeah. So I did my PhD, was formerly in material science at MIT, working on polymeric biomaterials for implants and regenerative medicine. And when I finished my graduate work, I went to do a postdoc with Mark Davis at Stanford. So shifted fields entirely to focus on immunology and T-cell biology, and then left Stanford to come back and start my own lab at MIT that was sort of bringing together what I had learned about biomaterials, materials chemistry, chemical engineering with applications in immunology. And so my lab for the last 20 years has been pursuing projects focused on making new technologies for vaccines, mostly focused on infectious disease, especially HIV and cancer immunotherapy, almost 50-50 between those two main areas.
And we're excited to dive in and learn a little bit more, but maybe before we do, we'd love to help get a grasp of the many experiences throughout your career. What has been the North Star or the common thread, if you will, that's been tying your work together?
You know, many of the projects in the lab you could think of as drug delivery targeted at the immune system. The immune system is this fascinating, you know, multicellular, multi-organ distributed network that protects from infection and cancer and other diseases. And really, the key to safely and effectively modulate the immune system is getting the right cue to the right immune cell at the right time and place. And so we are sort of main interest has been saying, well, for that drug that's just not going to work by administering it systemically at constant levels for many days, the way we deliver many cancer drugs, how can we do that in a more intelligent way to get the kind of immune response we're looking for and have it be safe and effective? And that same problem applies equally in cancer and vaccines.
No, it makes a lot of sense. And thank you for that background. I want to double click on that just for a moment, because as you mentioned, you began your academic career more in engineering physics before studying polymer science at MIT. And then I don't want to say radically, but shifting to a focus in immunology. Can you tell us a little bit more about what initially drew you to the field of immunology and maybe what the guiding principles were that led you to integrate immunology with material science?
Yeah. So, you know, as I was finishing up my PhD, I was in the biomaterials field doing the kinds of studies that a lot of people in the field were doing in the late 90s, trying to engineer implant surfaces that would regulate cell interactions, control what cells could attach or migrate or differentiate. And the main takeaway I had after, you know, 5 years of working in that field was that I didn't want to do that anymore. So I was talking to mentors about what areas of the life sciences have not really interfaced with bioengineering to the degree they might yet. And suggestions I got were cancer, neuroscience, and immunology. And I ruled out neuroscience. It just seemed too damn complicated. And immunology really caught my eye because of some of the work in the late 90s where people were really starting to understand how immune cell communication worked through structures like the immunological synapse. And in fact, some of the tools that people were using to study immune cells at that time, they looked crudely to me like biomaterials problems. People were making synthetic supported lipid bilayers to mimic the structure of a surface of a cell and seeing how a T cell would interact with that. So I had some maybe misguided notion that maybe I would have some things that I knew how to do that would be useful in the field of immunology. And, you know, and I was really, really fortunate that Mark Davis kind of took a chance on bringing in, you know, this engineer who knew nothing about, I couldn't tell a T cell from a B cell when I started, and had me, hosted me for a postdoc. And he had a really tremendous group of graduate students and postdocs in his lab that I learned, you know, all of immunology from, kind of a crash course very quickly. You know, once I was immersed in that field, it just has kept me entertained, excited, you know, so many interesting problems in health and disease in the field of immunology. And as I came out of his lab, it sort of crystallized for me this idea that we would try and develop better ways to modulate what immune cells are doing for therapy.
And as we think a little bit more about that modulation and what we can only call an incredibly well-guided belief that recently led to your National Academy of Medicine induction, I'm going to pass it to Jake to talk a little bit more about your lab and that intersection of immunology and materials. Jake?
Daryl, your lab at MIT, even, you know, 10 years ago when, you know, we were both younger men, and your lab had this incredible reputation at MIT. I remember when you came and presented to us as first year graduate students, and you talked about, you know, the focus on materials guided approaches, but to monitor and manipulate the immune system. Can you give, you know, the broader listeners here to this podcast now some more background on the founding of your lab? So for instance, you know, the goals at the time, and then as you got started and as you started to peel back the onion on the immune system using these materials, you know, the foundational questions that directed your earliest research and sort of the different pathways you chased down.
Well, you know, I think when we started, when the lab very first started, you know, maybe I think I was still in the phase of learning more about immunology because I had just come to it in my postdoc. So, you know, I think some of the initial things that we were trying to do, we were thinking about trying to build synthetic lymphoid organs to mimic what happens in a lymph node. We were thinking about, we had early ideas about designing nanomaterials to deliver vaccines to immune cells. That is a line of work that sort of had more legs to it. And we started thinking about cancer immunotherapy. So I think one of the things that really influenced the arc of my career is that we went from, you know, when I started my lab in 2002, immunotherapy was still like the ugly stepchild of cancer treatment. But I lived through the transformation that happened in the mid-2000s to 2010 or so, when checkpoint blockade and CAR T-cell therapy came on the scene, when all of a sudden immunotherapy was a reality and you could cure people with it. So that drove a lot that was happening in our thinking about, you know, what we should be trying to do. And so the vein of trying to work on cancer immunotherapy developed was not something that was in my earliest research plans when I started the lab, but became kind of front and center within a few years.
That's really great. I mean, your work has always been at a cross section of numerous scientific disciplines. I mean, we spoke earlier about how we were, you know, when I was working with you when we were at MIT back in 2012 and 2013, you're working on messenger RNA as well. So I think you're really a trendsetter being in both of those fields before they got nearly as hot as they've become and be there early. But, you know, within that cross-section of the newer scientific disciplines, you know, including biotechnology, materials chemistry, how does biology guide technology development in your lab? So you're a material scientist, you use materials to answer or interrogate these immunological mechanisms, but how does biology guide your technology development in your lab?
Yeah, I think that's actually the crucial piece of, you know, if there's anything that distinguishes what our lab is doing from some of the other, you know, now there's a whole field of immune engineering, which I'd say we played a pretty significant part in helping develop.
But I would say so.
But we're always focused on what's the immunology telling us. And now it's matured to the point where sometimes something we're doing, developing a new vaccine strategy, leads us to basic immunology studies that are really basic biology studies that were just led to by, you know, paying attention to what we're seeing happen in our experiments. So that's definitely, we are always starting from, well, what's the interesting immunology? And all the best ideas in the lab have come out of some exciting new development in immunology.
That's awesome. I'll turn it back to Chris now to talk a little bit about immunological engineering.
Yeah, and as we think about, thank you, Jake, thank you, Daryl, as we think about some of those landmark contributions that we've been hinting at, over the last 20 years, Daryl, your lab has made incredible contributions, primarily focused around, as you said, areas like nanoparticle vaccines, lymph node targeting, T-cell engineering, and honestly, we'd love to dive into all three. So going in no particular order, maybe we can start off by asking, what led you to use nanoparticles for vaccine delivery? And can you share a little bit more about maybe some of the technical hurdles in design or how the outcomes have really impacted vaccines and the field of immunization? I know that's a lot, so happy to break that down into parts as we go.
Yeah. Well, we by no means like invented the idea of using nanoparticles for vaccines. There have been preceding things we were doing, you know, people had realized that nanoparticles can promote vaccine uptake into lymphatic vessels to get the vaccine to the lymph node where you need it. And it was well understood that nanoparticles with many copies of antigen on their surface, they look like a viral particle, and therefore your immune system is sort of evolved to react to that. And B cells are very strongly activated when they see a particulate form of antigen. I think where we've come in to contribute has been sort of further asking, well, what else is unique about this way of formulating a vaccine? And we've discovered other interesting pathways that the immune system uses to respond to these particulate vaccines or viruses, such as the ability of a nanoparticle to trigger innate immune recognition pathways that will deliver nanoparticles to a particular region in the lymph node called the follicle, where B cell responses get started. And we discovered that that seems to actually be a pretty important part of why this type of vaccine works so well, in part through one of these forays into basic immunology, where we saw that particles that were delivered into follicles are retained in an intact state, whereas antigens that flush into the lymph node in a soluble form can get rapidly degraded. And it turns out that's because protease activity is compartmentalized spatially in the lymph node, where B cell follicles have low levels of protease activity and other regions of the lymph node, there's high levels of protease activity. So if you want to get an antigen into the lymph node in an intact form so that it can, say, promote a neutralizing antibody response, then anything that will send it into the follicles is an efficient way to do that. And that's one of the things that nanoparticles can do.
So, Daryl, switching gears, can you actually elaborate for the audience and for myself even, can you elaborate on why targeting lymph nodes is crucial for effective immunotherapies and share some of the complexities involved in actually targeting lymph nodes?
Yeah, so where we really dug into that problem was thinking about what makes cancer vaccines work or not work. And we started, I had a terrific postdoc come to the lab, Haipeng Liu, who was a chemist, and he'd say, I'm just a simple chemist. But he thought about vaccines as a physical chemistry problem, and he asked, where do vaccines go when you inject them? And one of the early discoveries he made, which in hindsight we should have predicted, was that if you took, for example, peptide vaccines used very frequently in cancer, that on injection, they largely get carried away by the bloodstream and diluted and degraded, and you're basically not getting hardly any material to the place where you need it, which is the draining lymph nodes. And so that led us on a whole sort of series of studies trying to understand how could you better deliver vaccines to lymph nodes and what are the principles that govern it. And so one of the important first technologies that we landed on was a strategy where, recognizing that albumin is constitutively coming out of the blood into tissues and then leaving through lymphatic vessels to go to lymph nodes, that you could redirect vaccines to lymph nodes simply by engineering the vaccine to bind to albumin. So you could take cancer antigens, link them to an albumin binding lipid tail, and on injection, they could bind to albumin that's already in the tissue and get carried downstream to lymph nodes. And this had a huge immunological effect. If you increased vaccine delivery tenfold to the lymph nodes, you could increase T cell activation by up to 30-fold. So these were not small effects. And the same sort of immunological impact is true for adjuvants as well. So low molecular weight vaccine adjuvants like toll-like receptor agonists, on injection, they can get carried into the blood, and then they not only lose efficacy, but they create a lot of toxicity. Whereas you could use this albumin hitchhiking strategy to send things to lymph nodes. And that was one of the first technologies that we were sort of convinced was promising enough that we spun it out of the lab, and that became Elicio Therapeutics, that's now headed toward phase two, testing that technology for cancer vaccines.
And so that actually gets to a point of my follow-up question, which is, where are lymph-associated therapies? Is this, you know, is Elicio really the pioneer? Are there others that have sort of followed into the space? And beyond that, what do you think is coming next for the space?
Yeah, there are a number of different, you know, approaches that achieve the same effect as the albumin hitchhiking. There's some beautiful work from an alumni from Lab, Chris Jewell, of using biomaterials to just directly inject therapeutics into lymph nodes for autoimmune disease. And, you know, all the excitement around mRNA therapeutics and mRNA vaccines, I think one of the things we don't understand well yet is in humans, how much of injected lipid nanoparticles make their way to lymph nodes directly. And if they don't do that efficiently, are there ways that we could engineer them to get there in a more facile manner? Would that, further enhance the safety and efficacy of vaccines, across all kinds of therapeutic applications?
That makes a lot of sense, and would love maybe even to dive slightly deeper there, if we may, just around the idea that, as the resident immunologist, Daryl, maybe you can offer us some thoughts. But in immunologically compromised circumstances, lymph nodes, to my limited understanding, will behave a little bit differently, be it in the case of oncology, autoimmune, or other disorders. Are there ways to start to address and get at the sort of biological insight around lymph biology to try and not only take advantage of approaches like albumin-based targeting, but also to try and understand at a deeper level what's really going on with the biology, so we can better do the immunological engineering to define therapies to bring us towards the lymphatic system?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And there are all sorts of scenarios where the lymph node itself is being affected by disease, like HIV, chronic HIV infection, cancer, tumor draining lymph nodes, and so on. It really depends on sort of case by case what disease setting you're talking about. But definitely, as an example, we've got a lot of work going on in the lab currently around intratumoral therapies, where we're really interested not in just injecting something into a tumor and having it modulate the tumor, but we're really interested in draining to the tumor draining lymph node from that injection to modulate what's happening in the lymph node. And if an immunosuppressive state has been created in the lymph node, can you overturn that and use that as a way to drive effective anti-tumor immunity? And I think that's really an area we're excited about expanding on.
That is going to be exciting to follow. Thank you for sharing it with us today. And as we think a little bit more about that tumor modulation, let's now shift gears again slightly and extend to your work with T cells. How do engineered T cells fit into your broader research agenda?
Yeah, so where, we were drawn to explore ways to improve T cell therapy, because if you, going back to the, around 2010, when these dramatic demonstrations of cancer immunotherapy effects in humans were first being reported, there have been two immunotherapy classes. One is checkpoint blockade with like anti-PD-1, anti-PD-L1, and so forth. And then there are CAR T-cell therapies for hematologic cancers. And the success of CAR T-cells in blood-derived cancers is contrasted with our overall, the real challenge that solid tumors have presented for CAR T-cell and other kinds of T-cell therapy. So we were really interested in, well, is there a way to make T-cell therapy work in the more common solid tumors, your pancreatic cancer, your brain cancer, so forth? And, we approached it sort of in the same way as these other projects of saying, well, what can we engineer that might promote CAR T-cell function? And we've pursued a few different sort of big ideas over the last 10 years or so. An early approach we took was asking, could you functionalize T-cells with particles that would release supporting drugs to enhance T cell function? And we showed, for example, that you could, and we called this quote unquote backpacking, loading cytokine drugs onto T cells, that wherever the cell went in the body was carrying this little package of drug along with it that would stimulate in the carrier cell in an autocrine manner. And from there, we sort of started thinking about what else one could do. And, this is where some of the different threads in the lab came together. So we had developed a strategy to target vaccines to lymph nodes, and we realized that that same approach could be used to deliver stimuli for CAR T cells in lymph nodes. And then you've created a scenario that's something like a vaccine for a CAR T cell. And that has looked really promising in preclinical models, where you, and creates a couple of effects. One is you you proliferate the CAR T cells. So now you have more CAR T cells, which is usually a good thing, promotes persistence of the CAR T cells. And most recently, we've shown that by vaccine stimulating CAR T cells and lymph nodes, when they leave the lymph node, they're programmed into a more functional state. And they do a really good job of, when they attack the tumor, of recruiting the endogenous immune system to come help with the job. And this maybe addresses one of the big challenges in T cell therapy of solid tumors, which is tumor antigen heterogeneity. So most solid tumors, not every tumor cell expresses the antigen. If you take glioblastoma, where people have tried targeting mutant EGFR receptor with CAR T cells, in some patients, 20% of the tumor cells have mutant EGFR. In other patients, it's 90% of the tumor cells. And in order for a therapy to have an effect in that patient with, 20% antigen positivity, what you really need is for the T cell therapy to induce an endogenous immune response that attacks other antigens. And we're seeing that this vaccine technology can help drive CAR T cells to promote that process that's called antigen spreading. And then the last example of a sort of a thread in that work is trying to solve the problem that there are some tumors for which we just don't know any antigens to target in solid tumors. And there we've explored the idea of designing molecules that basically paint tumor cells so that you inject them into a tumor and you basically paint the tumor with a target that a CAR T cell can attack, as a way to, in principle, make any tumor be targetable by an arbitrary single CAR, as a way to try and universalize CAR T cell therapy. So, it's all along been sort of identifying some of the key problems in the field and saying, well, what tricks do we have in the lab that we could maybe bring to bear?
Well, that was an incredible overview. Thank you, Daryl. And as we think briefly about those tricks, as you've so aptly phrased it, Jake, do you want to briefly talk to us about Strand's CAR T work?
Yeah. So, maybe to back up just quickly, the underlying thesis of what, we'd like to accomplish long-term at Strand is, by building messenger RNA molecules that are cell type specific, you can deliver specific payloads into certain cell types. Big limitation of messenger RNA has been the specificity of delivery via these different nanoparticles. And so, in the case of solid tumors, we think about that from building an mRNA that is only capable of expressing within a tumor cell. And then, both intratumorally, but even systemically, you can then deliver a messenger RNA that is specific and has a acceptable therapeutic index. But at a high level, the real challenge there is, can you make a messenger RNA molecule express a certain protein exclusively within a cell type? And then what could you do with that technology? And so we started asking ourselves that after we started to show some early successes with cell type specific messenger RNAs in solid tumors. Was this broadly applicable enough to other cell types to where we could build a T cell specific messenger RNA? And then rather than express something like a cytokine to excite an anti-tumor response, we want to express a chimeric antigen receptor. And so that's where, our work there is really focused. It's, delivering long expressing, building mRNA molecules that are, next generation modalities, which can express for weeks at a time. Once they're inside of these cells, those include, self-replicating and circular RNA modalities that we've become pretty good at designing and building, and then designing them with our circuit technology that allows them to be cell type specific, and then deploying that with a chimeric antigen receptor as the payload. And so, for us, it's really about the bad parts of CAR T scalability are, manufacturing issues. Sort of like an insane thing I think we do because it works, which is, take T cells out of the body, knock in a chimeric antigen receptor, grow up those cells and add them back into a patient while in the meantime lymphodepleting that patient. And all of that's essentially done because we're trying to get a gene into a T cell. And it creates unscalable technologies. It creates CAR therapies that are only available in certain areas of, even the developed world, like the United States, pockets of complete unavailability of those therapeutics. It creates drugs that are frankly, even though they cost patients a lot of money, they net no actual revenue for the companies that produce them. So sort of
patients end up paying, or payers end up paying an extreme amount of money for a therapeutic that no one is even making any money on, which is just sort of a sadness that is only made better by the fact that it does create patient value, because these therapeutics are so revolutionary and getting better with research like what Daryl's doing. So trying to build the railroad track.
Yeah, and I believe
CAR T production.
Yeah, I believe CAR T cell therapy triggered the invention of the phrase financial toxicity.
Yeah.
These things are just so expensive that it's untenable.
It's untenable. And it's great. You know, you look at the finances of you know, a company like BMS, which has Juno's CAR T inside of it. You know, Juno was acquired by Celgene and then merged with BMS. There's no real margin on that CAR T therapeutic. I mean, it is great for patients from a value, from a, you know, death's door to being able to have these, like, you know, miraculous responses. You know, but they're very expensive. They're hard to get. Some patients die waiting to get a manufacturing slot. There are so many issues with it. And what's sad about that to me is the fact that it's all because we do this huge rigmarole process in order to get a gene into the cell. That seems like a solvable problem for synthetic biology, in my opinion.
As we think about those solvable problems and maybe those challenges, and thank you, Jake, for that really phenomenal summary. One of the greatest challenges, it feels like, recently in developing immunotherapies has been achieving that durability of immune response you talked about, while limiting, in this case, not financial toxicity, but the systemic toxicities and adverse events that can come through. Daryl, you've touched on this briefly, but how does the research you're doing, either through your lab or companies you're involved in, like Strand, and Jake, feel free to jump in, how do you start to address some of these challenges?
You know, I mentioned we have a big interest in intratumoral therapy, and that's one of the ways that we've been exploring, can you make immunotherapies that are more tolerable and effective by designing them such that you put them into a tumor or a tumor-draining lymph node and you keep them there? And the key for that, of course, is that they have to elicit an immune response that disseminates beyond that treated site. Because you're not going to put a needle into every lesion in a patient with metastatic disease in almost any solid tumor scenario. So we're really studying, A, what are technologies to achieve that fundamental goal of putting a drug in a tumor and keeping it there? And then secondly, what are the cues that would allow you, for example, to program a T-cell response in a tumor-draining lymph node that can go to all the untreated tumors and infiltrate them and destroy them? So that's an area I've been working on. And now a lot of our work, in collaboration with my neighbor at MIT, Dane Wittrup, who's a protein engineer, we've been working together on this problem for quite some time. And that's included some of the work that was like the genesis for what was initially going to become Strand, of exploring self-replicating RNAs is a way to promote those kind of effects. And that's also the basis of one of the other startups that I've been involved in, Ancura, which is using a different approach of using a physical biomaterial alum as a way to anchor immunotherapy drugs in a tumor. But certainly what Jake's talking about with cell type specific expression is definitely one strategy to try and achieve that goal in the future.
Many different ways that we have to all, you know, try to solve some of these core issues. But actually, you know, now taking a step back from some of this biological engineering, thinking about, you know, in recent years, big data generation, computational processing, machine learning, AI, deep learning, pick your favorite version of the buzzword for that field. But, you know, computational processing has enabled the beginnings of a potential shift in medicine, from, you know, possibly one size fits all methods to more individualized approaches and also better data processing. I think oncology and possibly now immunology are going to be some of the first places targeted for these types of therapies. So I'd love to, you know, Daryl, ask your thoughts about bringing together wet lab work with data and technology, and how that possibly enables high throughput of biological understanding. And then further than that, do you have any ongoing projects that, you know, integrate you know, not even just computational methods, but even machine learning and pieces like that into your immunological research?
Yeah, I mean, we think about this a lot these days. I would say it's very limited for what we in my lab are doing so far. We're in the earliest stages of trying to use those methods in analyzing responses to vaccines, for example, where we are able to, for example, generate large data sets by sequencing responding B cells, for example. You know, it's obviously an area that we need to think about how can that help drive what we're doing forward. But I'd say we're still figuring that out for ourselves, given our skill set and what we can do. How can we best link into that?
And there's always room to grow and time to figure it out. But for now, pivoting slightly, would love to ask Daryl just a few rapid fire questions. Get your thoughts on a couple of maybe broader, higher level topics. The first one being, what's a question you wish more people were asking?
Well, some of the questions we're asking ourselves that I think the field needs to think about more, you know, in cancer immunotherapy, I think we're greatly limited by the models we have. So, you know, the majority of preclinical studies are done in rodents. And we know there are many limitations to rodent models, many ways that they don't model the toxicity and immune signaling that happens in humans. And I think we need to ask ourselves how we do better. And so I'm excited about some of the work that my neighbor Dane's lab is doing, looking at canine models of cancer, where you're now working in an outbred animal, working with tumors that are physically, you know, for intratumoral therapy, for example, we've realized that there's a big difference between injecting a half centimeter mouse tumor versus a tumor on a canine or a human that could be, you know, multiple centimeters across. This is just a totally different ball game. So I think that's an area that we should be thinking about. What steps can we take to test immunotherapy treatments in better models so that we have a better idea of what's going to go wrong when we try and go to humans? And then the other big one for me is, I think there's rightful, tremendous enthusiasm around the prospect of mRNA for vaccines, but we really have a very poor understanding of exactly what happens when you inject mRNA into a person. Where does it go? What cells get transfected? And then what happens next? And that's something we're also really interested in trying to get our better handle on. And I think many, many people are interested in those questions also.
Oh, absolutely. And as you come up with the answers, we'd love to have you back to chat a little bit more about them. But for now, and to build on that just a bit, in your opinion, what is the most promising emerging technology in your space?
There are many possible answers to that, I guess. And connected with having Jake here, I will say I'm excited about the prospects of marrying the kind of, if you will, drug delivery mediated modulation of immune cells being married with the exciting things that are happening in synthetic biology applied to immunotherapy, especially cell therapy. So it's going to be very exciting to see what happens in clinical trials of these synthetic biology enabled T cell therapies, for example, where T cells are being designed that can better sense their environment, that interpret what sets of antigens are available and in the environment. And the prospect of, say, combining that kind of a smarter cell therapy with strategies like the vaccine boosting approach that we developed for boosting CAR T cells, I think could be really exciting. And you know, not 10 years in the future, maybe 5 years in the future.
So Daryl, taking this back to, you know, your entrepreneurial mindset of how you run your lab and various experiences, how do you think about mentorship and lab culture within your lab at the Koch Institute?
I think we just had the summer 20th anniversary reunion for the lab. I can't believe I've been here 20 years. And so it got me thinking about that question a bit. And I have to say that really, I think a guiding principle was that early on, I figured out that the best way to get you know, the most productive lab was to make sure that the trainees in the lab have all the support they need. And if I'm doing what's best for the trainees, then that turns out almost always to be what's best for the lab moving to move forward and do great science. And my main goal is to teach students and postdocs to implement that principle in their future lives, as they're all going to go out and mentor colleagues, coworkers, and their own trainees.
That's awesome. So, and then so beyond that leadership within your own lab, you know, over the years, you've been a founder or on the board of, I think, 8 different companies, at least by my own notes, you know, Alicia and Cara, there's this really cool mRNA company called Strand Therapeutics. You've been involved with all of them. But given your experience as a, you know, as a co-founder, as an SAB member during this moment in biotech, you know, how do you decide as a technologist, as a, you know, as an academic researcher who is so prolific here, how do you decide when a technology is ready to spin out of the lab? And are there certain elements that you look for, you know, before joining a startup, maybe if, you know, depending on how they come to you, whether it's from your lab or someone who wants to recruit you because of your expertise?
I think for our own work, you know, the take-home lesson that I've got from doing this a couple of times, though, you know, all these companies are still youngish, Strand is youngish.
Yeah.
is that we want to kick the tires on a technology as hard as we can in the lab before we spin it out. You know, the runway that a startup has to really make things happen is very short. So you need to really give if you're going to make that spin out happen or license or hand off to A, be as confident as you are that you've tested it in the most rigorous models and that it really does work, because you're just wasting your time if you're not sure of that. And secondly, you know, how far can you take it? Is it really one step away from translation? Do you have a mouse version of a therapy that has to be converted to a human version? Because that's going to take time and create risk. So we're always trying to think along those lines. And then lastly, we're always asking ourselves, what's the simplest way to do this? Because simpler is better. Robust is the way to go for something to successfully get out of the lab and into patients.
And then
and you know, for other companies, those are the same questions I'd be asking them.
Those are very, like, incredibly insightful. So any advice for academics in our audience, how best to serve as an advisor and SAB, you know, interact with, you know, startups, that startup environment?
Well, the main advice I would have for other academics thinking about getting involved with companies is it's a great opportunity to get a strong sense of what industry is doing and capable of, so that your own work can be informed. I've learned a tremendous amount from any companies that I've interacted with over the years, and it's definitely helped shape my thinking about what can succeed if you're trying to translate it out of, you know, academic bench research and nice papers into actual patient treatments.
As we think about that translation to patient treatments, Jake, would love to hear from you how Daryl's experience has really enabled your work at Strand. Put Daryl in the spotlight for a moment in a different way.
Well, you know, early on, I got to, you know, Daryl wasn't my direct PhD advisor, but due to the nature of our close collaboration through the DARPA program, those meetings were weekly or every other week. I mean, we'd meet at 500 Tech Square, which is where Ron's lab was, to discuss the ongoing progress of the DARPA project pretty regularly. And I got, you know, I attribute that a lot to my own ability as a scientist and the technology that we were developing to be, you know, in the world of synthetic biology 10 years ago and mammalian synthetic biology, there was thoughts about translation, but it was more about, and this is how it might translate in the future, but no one was putting it to the test. And what we were doing was we were building things, we were going in vitro, in vivo, straight, like, we were, if it didn't work in a translational setting, for synthetic biology, we weren't concerning ourselves with toy systems. And for me, that was an incredibly, that was exactly why I came to MIT. That was exactly what I wanted to work on. I did not want to work on things that I didn't see as translational. And because of that work, it then enabled us to go on and start the company. As we've started the company, I mean, I think anyone who listens to this up until this point knows that Daryl's just an incredible genius, insight into the world of not just immunology, but really, you know, the complex systems and how they interplay with each other. You know, we've tried to go after some very ambitious things. We've, you know, had conversations and very frank conversations about, you know, what looks good for a target, where we're going to start, how we're going to start in immunotherapy. All of that's been informed by, you know, Daryl's scientific expertise. And it's been, you know, just an incredible shoulder to sort of stand on to get my own career started. So super thankful for being able to work with just such intelligent people like Daryl over the past 10 years. And yeah, it has been 10 and a half almost.
Oh. And to tie it back to where we started of us first meeting, this was a very fun and productive collaboration when we first got together with Jake and Jake's mentor, Ron, where from my side, we were saying, well, these are the problems we have. And they would tell us, well, we can do X, Y, and Z with these synthetic biology approaches. And so that just opened doors to say, oh, you can do that. All right. And that's really, I think, a lot of those moments are what ended up becoming Strand.
It's exactly it. And that culture, just to even build off of what Daryl just said, because I'm realizing that I feel like I created the culture here at Strand how I thought was best, but actually I didn't do it. I'm just copying what Daryl and Ron were doing when we were at MIT, which was this, you know, you have these tools, but if you run around trying to solve problems for a theoretical future, like, you know, you're like, oh, you know, people in translational immunology have this problem, so I'm going to go solve the problem. But when you have the people, you get them together regularly. I mean, that is, yeah, Daryl, you nailed it. That's exactly what the early part was like. And that's why I think we were able to move so fast.
Even now, we're still seeing how Daryl's helping post Strand forward. So thank you both for that very prescient. But before we come to a close, maybe one, two quick questions just to wrap things up. Daryl, one question we love to ask our guests comes from Nobel laureate Denis Gabor, who said, "The future cannot be predicted, but the future can be invented." As someone who's done a volume of groundbreaking work, can you share with us what does inventing the future mean to you?
For my lab, it's been paying attention to the unexpected results. I would say more than half of the really exciting things that we've developed in the group, they were unexpected things that we asked ourselves, what's going on here? And we chased it down, and that led to new immunology, led to new therapy ideas. You know, we're always trying to approach things rationally and say, well, my hypothesis is this is happening, and therefore I'm going to design my treatment this way. But your hypothesis is always based on the things you know, and it's the things you don't know that are what make science interesting. So.
And that's a great message and North Star. And as we think about that work, how can our listeners learn more about you and your work?
Well, it's kind of boring, but I guess the lab website. I am not active on Twitter or the former Twitter.
Understandably so. Daryl, Jake, thank you for an absolutely fantastic episode. Daryl, a huge congratulations again on your recent induction. We are very grateful for your time, truly enjoyed the conversation, and look forward to having you back on the show again soon. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the BIOS podcast. If you enjoyed it, please leave a review on your favorite podcasting platform. For more content, please visit bios.community or alix.vc.
Hello and welcome to BIOS podcast. Today, we're absolutely thrilled to welcome serial entrepreneur, professor at MIT, HHMI investigator, and the associate director of the Koch Institute for Integrative Cancer Research. Daryl, thank you once again for joining us, and a huge congratulations for just this Monday being inducted into the National Academy of Medicine.